I'm Christy Potter. I'm a journalist, I'm an author, and I'm going gray. This show is about all the amazing, creative, and inspiring people out there every day making the world a more interesting place. Before we get to today's guest, a couple of quick things to share with you. First, please check out my author page on Amazon.com. It has links to both of my books, which are available in paperback and for Kindle. There's also a little video and some information about me and all that good stuff. So that is amazon.com/author/Christy Potter. Also, while you're on the web, please take a moment and visit audible.com, the audiobook people. Two reasons for you to do that. Number one, because they have just a ton of books, both old and new. And number two, because you listen to this podcast, you can get a free month's membership and a free audiobook download. All you have to do is go to audible.com/goinggray and get signed up. My guest today is Nashville-based writer Brian Kinnard, author of Steinbeck, Citizen Spy. This book will, as Brian promises, blow away everything you thought you knew about Steinbeck. I'll let him fill you in on the rest. Brian, thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me on.
Your book, just, wow, I'm just blown away by this whole topic. So I'm just going to let you tell us a little bit first how you became interested in this subject.
Well, about 6 or 7 years ago, I got on a kick, as most people approaching their 40s do, to reread the classics that we were forced to read in college and high school, and was in a used bookstore and was looking for Steinbeck books. And I knew about it as much about Steinbeck as any college graduate does. And I saw a copy of The Acts of King Arthur and His Noble Knights. And I had no idea Steinbeck had rewritten Thomas Mowry's L'Amour d'Arthur. And Arthurian legend and Holy Grail legend has always been kind of a little minor fascination for me. So I picked it up. And in the introduction notes, there was a mention of a man named Chase Horton, who was Steinbeck's research assistant for this project. Mm-hmm. And I kind of became fascinated with Horton because he was very understated and he did a ton of work for Steinbeck. And he owned a bookstore in Greenwich Village named Washington Square Books that was a very hipster-type bookstore from, gosh, the 1920s on till the 50s or 60s when it finally was sold off. And I thought there was a hidden story in Horton's life. Well, as I come to research Steinbeck and his life, I keep finding names that pop up that have intelligence agency connections. I would do things like, instead of going to the beach, I would go to the Stanford Archives and dig through letters, or to the New York Public Library Special Collections section where Horton's journals were at. And one of the names that popped up was Frederick Prager in Horton's journals. And Prager was an intelligence officer during World War II, and he went on to publish books for the CIA, amongst any number of other books. So I looked in Steinbeck's background, and he had worked for the OSS and the War Information Office during World War II. Mm-hmm. So I began to wonder, well, did Steinbeck's intelligence work from World War II carry over later? And the seminal moment came when I was reviewing Steinbeck's FBI file, and that's available online either at the FBI's Vault website or at SteinbeckCitizenSpy.com. It's been out for years, and I looked at it. I'd read it half a dozen times for content, but I looked at it one more time looking for who was requesting information, where was information being sent to, and three little letters popped out that I'd never noticed before, CIA. At least five times in Steinbeck's 120-page FBI file, there are requests for information by the CIA. There are two full pages of his FBI file redacted by the CIA, and a number of instances where the CIA has redacted information or information has been redacted for national security reasons. Mm-hmm. So why would the CIA be interested in Steinbeck? So I decided to ask the CIA. So, and gosh, the beginning of 2012, I sent a Freedom of Information Act request to the CIA. And over the next few months, I'd get responses back that were, rather officious. We've got your request. We're processing your request. And it's kind of unnerving getting a letter from the CIA because they put, it's a normal business size envelope, but they put this thick brown tape on the back of it to make sure that it hadn't been tampered with.
Yeah, that'd be a little unnerving.
And I'm sure my postman was kind of freaking out during this time because I'd sent stuff off to the Department of Justice, Naval Intelligence, all sorts of government agencies were mailing me. So in August of 2012, I received two letters from the CIA that it was a very thin envelope, and I didn't think much about it. And I'd done other FOIA requests from them and gotten nothing of merit back, so I really didn't have hopes for this. I couldn't have been more wrong. Enclosed was a 1952 letter, or a copy of a 1952 letter, in John Steinbeck's own hand to Walter Beadle Smith, who was the director of Central Intelligence at the time. He also was the ambassador to Russia at one point and Eisenhower's right-hand man during World War II. And Steinbeck describes a trip that he's going to be taking in Europe, and he's going to be writing articles for Collier's magazine. And at the end of the letter, Steinbeck, in his own words, says, "Again, I shall be pleased to be of service. The pace and method of my junket, together with my intention of talking with a great number of people of all classes, may offer peculiar advantages." The next letter is from the director of Central Intelligence, Walter Beadle Smith, back to Steinbeck. And he says, "Yes, indeed, you can be of help to us." And I actually suggest that Steinbeck comes to Washington before his trip to be briefed and request that he set aside a debriefing time for him. So we have the smoking gun here. We have a pattern of behavior of Steinbeck working with the intelligence community during the Second World War. And now we have Steinbeck requesting service with the CIA and the CIA accepting. And since the CIA has released another document that conveys that a number of Steinbeck's suggestions were talked about in a department head meeting in 1951. And unfortunately, those were released after the publication of my book. But all this is on the CIA's Freedom of Information Act website, and anybody, once again, can go see this. So Steinbeck was involved with the Central Intelligence Agency and the intelligence services of the United States from at least 1940, and I postulate at least until 1964, with his last trip to the Soviet Union.
I think I'm very curious now after you've done all this, and I have other questions as well, but the one that keeps coming to my mind while you're talking is, what do you think now? I mean, he obviously, I can see his point. He's in a very unique position where people are willing to talk to him. You know how writers are. They can get anybody to talk about anything, if they have any interview skills at all, and it can just seem like a conversation. They can get all kinds of crazy information. Was he traitor to the people, or was he an American
I
hero?
think he was an American hero. Steinbeck, the view of Steinbeck by most people is he was a far leftist, probably a communist, and that comes from the Grapes of Wrath days when he caught the ton of flack that he did for the publication of that. Those rumors actually barred his service, uniform service in World War II. And his work with the intelligence services and the War Information Office and being a war correspondent, it kind of sidestepped that. But Steinbeck had a vehement hatred for Stalinistic communism. In speaking with Steinbeck's son Thomas, John wasn't so worried about American communists because they couldn't get out of bed in time to attend rallies. It was something that John always said. But the stifling conditions in Russia right after the Cold War and during the height of the Cold War was repellent to Steinbeck. I mean, the man who fights for the common man. That's what we have to remember about Steinbeck. And communism to him represented a total affront to that and a total repression of an entire society.
What a lot of people felt like that at that time. So, that was very much the whole blacklisting thing, and so yeah, I could see that.
Well, and oddly enough, even with all the ties, supposed ties that Steinbeck had to the Communist Party and friends of his that had been blacklisted, Steinbeck was never called before HUAC. And in a letter to his editor in relation to Elia Kazan's testimony to HUAC, Steinbeck tells his editor, Pacevici, "Nobody really knows what they'll do when they're put in that situation. I will never know. How strange is that?" And this was written on the same trip in 1952. So unless Steinbeck was psychic, how would he know that at the height of McCarthyism, he would never be called before HUAC unless he had certain assurances? So we start looking at Steinbeck's life with anomalies like that in this post-1952 period and with the trip in 1952. And we can fairly easily extrapolate what he was doing for the CIA and parts of his life that intersect with other people in the intelligence community.
Tell me a little bit. I wanted to get back to something you said. Tell me a little bit about working with Steinbeck's son. I know he wrote the introduction to your book includes a note from him. Tell us more about his reaction how you came in touch with him and what his reaction was and how he helped you.
Well, I'd actually talked to Thomas in 2008 when I first started looking into John's fascination with Arthurian lore. And we talked for about an hour. And I decided that once I got this material, I wasn't going to contact Tom until I had a workable manuscript and the lion's share of my research was done. I mean, you just don't call up somebody and say, "Hey, guess what? Your dad was a secret agent." So I got in contact, or I emailed Tom and got a response from his wife, Gail, who is Tom's gatekeeper and just a wonderful person. And I told her about my research and what I'd uncovered. And she told me after my little spiel that I should definitely talk with Tom and he'd be calling me in the next couple of days and that she could totally see John doing something like this. So a couple of days later, Thomas calls me and he didn't remember talking with me years before, which is no great surprise. Tom talks to a great number of people on a daily basis. And so I go through my spiel once again and Thomas is silent throughout the entire thing. And one of the things I found out through this too was the FBI has destroyed portions of John's FBI file, which seems pretty egregious to me. And I told him that, and Thomas finally breaks the silence and says, "So what do you think about that?" I said, "Well, Tom, I think it's crap. They've got it. They just don't want to release it." He said, "That's what I think too." He said, "I always knew my father was up to something, but the FBI always hated him. Hoover hated him." And so we started talking about things, and kind of a friendship between myself and Thomas grew from that. He would call me every couple weeks, and he started remembering things from his childhood. And he was born in 1944, so a lot of this stuff is going on when Thomas is a very young man. But I would get stories out of Thomas, like in 54, they lived in Paris, and somebody from the State Department would come by every couple of days and drop off an attaché case for John. And somebody would come back in a couple of days and pick it back up. And that happened for a number of months that they were in Paris. They would also, every Thursday, John would take Thomas and John the Fourth, his brother, on little trips that John called getting lost around Paris. And supposedly they'd drive to a random location, or what the kids thought was a random location. But mm-hmm. Thomas remembers that a lot of those trips, John would magically meet somebody that he knew and would talk with. And Thomas thinks that that very well could have been a cover for John's covert activities. Now, unfortunately, Thomas is very enamored with my research. He's fully behind it. But John never talked about this, as any good operative wouldn't. And right. so Thomas can't confirm or deny any of this, other than stand on my research and stand behind me. And Thomas was kind enough to write a note for the introduction of the book, and he was an integral part of the writing of it, supplying stories and such. So pretty thankful to him for his input.
That must have felt so weird for you to get him on the phone and say, well, you just said, hey, guess what, your father was a spy. You know, I mean, just like, hey, how are you?
Well, I know. And one of the things that both Gail and him asked me a number of times early on was, why didn't you just publish without mm-hmm. talking with us? And I couldn't do that. I mean, that's no. Thomas is part of this story. And you just can't let someone read in a newspaper or hear on an interview, hey, this guy's written a book that postulates that your father was a spy based on some evidence he's gotten from the CIA and FBI. That's just not done. So,
no.
Yeah, I had to contact him, but it was awkward, and I wasn't sure what his reaction would be.
Uh-huh.
But they definitely don't think that I'm tinfoil hat worthy, so that's something.
That's excellent. That's excellent. So Steinbeck is really an American literary hero, and this really casts him in a different light. What kind of a reaction have you gotten?
Mostly it's been positive. I was on Coast to Coast AM last week and was flooded with emails of support for this. Now, the academic community has been a little slower to react.
Yeah, I'm sure.
Yeah, you know, that happens. I did have a long conversation with the head of the Steinbeck Society, Lucian Lee, about my work, and they're planning on reviewing it in the Steinbeck Quarterly in the fall, I believe. But he was very interested in what my intentions were with writing this, or why I did this.
Mm-hmm.
And it's not to be sensational. It's to add to the life of a great American. And this is just an unknown part of it. So I really wanted to get to the truth of the matter. And, yes, there's a lot of dangling questions in my text, but the letters that I've gotten from the CIA and the other information that's contained within Steinbeck's FBI file necessitates us opening a dialogue about Steinbeck's life and looking at the hidden parts of it in an area that no one's delved into before.
Right. Do you, this is going to come out of the blue because you're not aware that I'm going to ask this, but if you have a copy close by, can you read us just a little snippet?
Sure. Hold on.
I figured you would.
Well, I have the letters pulled up because I usually have something. I'm trying to think what would be a good portion.
Yeah, I'm fascinated. I can't wait to read this. I'm fascinated.
Well, I've got an excerpt while I'm trying to find something. I've got most of the introduction at Steinbeck Citizen Spy.
Okay.
Let's see. I've already talked about that. Oh, gosh.
I know, I really put you on the spot with this.
It's all right.
But we're patient. We can wait. While you're doing that, you said it's SteinbeckCitizenSpy.com is where you can find out more about this book. Can we order it from there? Or?
Yes. Okay. It's all over the place on the web. You can also go to gravedistractions.com, which is a publishing company I own.
Okay.
We publish all sorts of different titles, but the information is there. Let's see. I think I've got a good section. Once I pull it up, Steinbeck, when he was a war correspondent during the Second World War, for a time was with Douglas Fairbanks Jr. and a elite naval commando unit called the Beach Jumpers. And these guys were a prototype SEAL unit, and they would conduct all sorts of disinformation campaigns in the Mediterranean. And Steinbeck would actually go on missions with them, which is totally forbidden for war correspondents, to take up arms, and could actually be shot as a spy if captured. Let's see. At every opportunity John had over the past few weeks, he had retired the accursed armband, referring to his war correspondent armband that all correspondents were tasked with wearing, to his belongings aboard the USS Knight before leaving for a mission, and dutifully replacing the armband after an action was conducted. The story was a platform for Douglas Fairbanks Jr.'s commando group, and John took every chance he could to accompany his friend on missions. John replaced his green woolen armband with a Tommy gun. One of the lads from Lieutenant Fairbanks' group would sneak an extra weapon on a patrol boat that whisked the men to their mission site. The risk of stripping his status as a war correspondent was not lost on John or Fairbanks. Fairbanks could have been severely reprimanded for issuing weapons to a civilian. For John, if captured, he would have no combatant status under the Geneva Convention and would have been considered a spy. While the rulebook for warfare did call for those accused of espionage at trial, there's little doubt what would happen if John was captured. The only hearing he might receive was that of a torturous interrogation before receiving a lead medal for bravery in the back of his head. So, John's actions during World War II, this is another kind of untold story about Steinbeck's life during the Second World War. It's mentioned vaguely in his biographies, but I delve into it fairly heavily in Citizen Spy, once again, to show a pattern of behavior of Steinbeck and to show that Steinbeck was not the man that we thought that he was.
And as a writer, you kind of get, you know, even though you're writing this, you know, not as a novel, you're writing this as a true to life piece, you still have to kind of get in his head, don't you?
Well, definitely. His motivations are key to understanding his actions, as with any person. And I think the great flaw that some of Steinbeck's biographers have made is they're more concerned about Steinbeck's life as it applies to his works, which is definitely worthy, but it misses this entire picture of his life. So I think that's why that's been overlooked over the years, because, you know, we try to backwards engineer why great writers have been able to achieve what they have and what influences in their life show up in their work. And with those blinders on, it's easy to miss things like this and other anomalies that are quite glaring once they're put out in the open.
Right. This is your second book, correct?
Yes.
Yeah, do you want to give a little shout-out to your first book?
My first book, which I like to call it my practice book, was Skullduggery, 45 True Tales of Disturbing the Dead. And that was pretty fun to write. Years ago, I had conducted an interview with Patrice Chaplin, who was Charlie Chaplin's daughter-in-law. And doing some background research on the Chaplin family, I found out that Charlie's body had been stolen from the gravesite in Switzerland where he was buried. And this was in 1977. And I thought, my God, this happened within my lifetime.
Yeah.
Do grave robberies still happen? And I found out, yes, they do, with quite frequency. And started finding little stories here and there that are not gruesome in any respect, but they're fun and they're quirky and they remind us of our mortality and sometimes the ridiculousness of death and the lengths that people will go to either cling on to life via the dead or use the dead for their own purposes. So it was a fun little project and really kicked off both my writing full time and opening up Grave Distractions Publications.
And you're not afraid to jump in there and do the research either. My hat's off to you.
Well, thank you. This
Stuff is a lot of digging, if you'll pardon the pun. Sorry. Ooh, that was terrible.
No, it's all right. No, and I love the hunt. I love going to, like I said, been to Stanford and other places throughout the country doing research. And I'm happiest doing that. I know that sounds very nerdy, but at 2 a.m. when you find a document or a travel log or something that makes sense, it makes it all worth it.
Of course, of course. And as a fellow writer, I know just exactly what you mean. And you were talking earlier about, you know, your friends are off doing one thing, and you're going to the library and you're digging through the public archives. That's why we do this.
It is.
It is. It's what keeps us going. It's what makes our blood pump. So, well, I really appreciate you taking this time with us. Again, everyone, Brian Kinnard. The book is called Steinbeck's Citizen Spy. Steinbeckcitizenspy.com. I asked you that before and now I forgot. Is that
That's
right?
correct.
Okay. So, and you can find the book on the web, so please do check it out. Brian, do you have a website as well where people can find out more about you?
Once again, either through citizenspy.com or through Grave Distractions.
Grave Distractions.
I do write, well, I haven't written in quite a while for a blog I maintain called Grail Seekers, but I'm a fairly busy fellow between trying to write and publish other people's works at this point. So if the folks will forgive me for that.
Yeah, I think we will, and we're looking forward to seeing what you uncover next.
Thanks.
Okay, thanks for joining
All
us.
right.
All right, that's it for me. Thanks for joining us. I will be back here again on Monday, which, as you know, is St. Patrick's Day, and I have a very special guest on that day I'm very excited about. In the meantime, you can find my books on Amazon. You can find earlier episodes of this podcast on iTunes, and as always, my home base is ChristyTheWriter.com.